600 spot on your dial. WICC, Bridgeport, Connecticut.
I'm Bud Finch, and I'll be back right after Andy Corona's news. Next, over the sound of New Haven, WELI.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Bob Steele of WTIC Hartford, speaking to you from the Army's Bradley Field in central Connecticut, where 25 or 30 big four-engine bombers have arrived in the past hour or so. More are coming in all the time.
The latest news from the WTHT Hartford Times newsroom.
Town Hartford, we bring you Hartford Speaks, transcribed. I'm Bob Maher. Here's Una King.
Well, you bright little spring boy, you're anticipating it a little bit, aren't you?
That's number 83, everybody, at WTIC, our Dickie Robinson Countdown Show. As we check out the top 100 records for 1967.
The Ken Griffin Show, WPOP.
From high atop Radio Mountain at 95.7, this is WBMI Hartford, Meriden. My name is Dan Bloom.
Connecticut Radio Memories, a series chronicling the first six decades of Connecticut's radio stations, as told by the people behind the microphones and behind the scenes. Episode 4, Radio Under the Umbrella, Part 2. More stories of the radio stations of the Travelers Insurance Company.
TIC used to hold auditions regularly.
Bill Hennessy.
This is one of the last of its kind of stations, the real old button-down professional network-type operations owned by the Travelers Insurance Companies, and they operated in a big scale. And I went for one of the weekly auditions and didn't realize it, but a year later, after taking the first audition, they called me back in for a second audition, which kind of surprised me because I didn't think that I'd gotten anywhere the first time. Well, what I didn't realize when I went back for the second audition is they were getting ready to launch a TV station, WTIC TV Channel 3, and it turns out that I was one of the first employees, but I joined the announcing staff. We had two studios, two control rooms, two sets of directors. It was a big operation, even though this was before it had a network affiliate. So I went to work at TIC Radio. The same day, another broadcasting legend from these parts started, although I started on a Saturday, and he didn't start till Monday, but the work week was that we both started the same day. That was George Ehrlich. I came up from CCC. They hired a bunch of other people, but on the announcing staff, we were the two that added to a large existing staff, which included Ed Anderson and Floyd Richards and Bruce Kern and Bob Ellsworth, who had come a year before, and Dick Bertel, Bob Errol. It was a cast of thousands, all very qualified, good professional people. Right. We did AM, FM, and TV announcing. We did classical music on the FM, for example. We did whatever the assignment happened to be on AM, whether it was news or music or whatever. When they had an opening for a noontime program, what they did, and it was a cute idea, was they auditioned all the announcing staff who was interested to try out a half-hour show for a week or a two-week period, and at the end of everybody going through this, see which one would fit in best with their programming ideas. And I came up with the idea of doing big band music, the swing era, which is what I grew up listening to.
Hi, Bill Hennessy here. Hennessy, that's me, of the good old songs from the good old days. I have a veritable string of pearls to weave for you. You know, Benny Goodman, Glenn Miller, the Dorseys, Artie Shaw, etc. Well, I revive such memories every noontime from 12:15 to 1. So come on back to the 30s and 40s and swing along with me daily on WTIZ.
So the records that I featured in that noontime show, which was then called Music Break, became the basis for the show that ended up being called Hennessy, That's Me. And that ran for all the time that I was there. And on TV, we were basically booth announcers. Every half hour, Channel 3, Hartford. That was about it. Although we also were on camera. Bob Ellsworth did the news at 11 o'clock. Bruce Kern did the 6 o'clock news. He was the SO reporter. We did commercials or whatever was required of us. They had a fellow named Ranger Andy, whose real name was Orville Andrews, who's no longer with us. He's dead. But he did the kiddie show in the afternoon, which later on became Floyd Richards' show. Floyd did Hap Richards with a whole bunch of other people. And so we got a little bit of everything.
Brad Davis.
Dick Zwerko.
Yeah, I worked with Brad. Brad was quite a character. Brad loved to do his rock and roll shows, and he was sort of in parallel with some of the early American bandstand up in Philly. He was doing the same thing up in Hartford on TV, and of course, he was Mr. Rock and Roll.
How I got to Hartford, it's quite a story, I guess, by accident. I came to Hartford in 1958. I had come out of the Marine Corps, and I was at a small station up in Chicopee, Massachusetts, WACE, from 1956 to 1957. And there was one time in the afternoon that I was doing a show. Eventually, I was there, and this was in the latter part of 57. And I was playing a Coca-Cola commercial, and I thought I'd be cute. Almost got fired. Thought I'd be cute, and I said, you know, I said, this is great, Coca-Cola. I said, but you know, the greatest drink of them all is milk. I mean, a nice cold glass of milk. I said, you know, I'm right on a dairy farm. My grandfather is a milk peddler and has 40 head that he's milking, and I just love milk. Well, I was talking about milk, and late that afternoon, somebody from Hartford was on the phone, and his name was Leo Kaufman. You know, Bob Kaufman, and Bob's Discount Furniture, well, his dad. And his dad had an advertising agency, and he said, boy, he said, that sounded great this afternoon, your conversation about milk. And he said, next fall, September of 58, we are going to sponsor, we being the 2,400 dairy farmer members of Connecticut Milk for Health, we are going to sponsor a teenage dance program. We're going to try it out for 13 weeks, and I'd like to have you come into Hartford to Channel 3 and audition for it. I said, I have never been in a television studio. I haven't even seen a television camera. I said, I think you're making a mistake. Well, he said, look, what have you got to lose? So I came in to Channel 3, and this was in 1957, late 57, all right? And it was at night, about 6:30, 7 o'clock, and I walked into the studio. This was the old Travelers building. Broadcast House was not built yet. So I went in, and there's four or five guys, and they all had these First National jackets on. So I figured out we must be doing a First National commercial of some kind. Yeah, these guys were good. I mean, I was the last one to go. They were just tremendous. Read the teleprompter. Well, I, as I said, was the last one, and I was so outrageous that I could even hear the engineers laughing in the control room because I'd lose my place in the prompter. And we were selling Friends beans. I'll never forget it. That was the product. And I'd pick it up, and I'd look over here, and I'd be upside down. It was awful. It was terrible. So I got so frustrated at the end, I just said to everybody, okay, let's just hold it. I said, I don't even know what you call that thing that the other guys were reading off of, but I've got a story to tell you. I said, I live on my grandfather and grandmother's dairy farm, and I said, Saturday nights, we always have hot dogs, brown bread, and baked beans. And I can remember my grandmother to this day soaking her pea beans, as she called them, on a Friday morning, and getting them all ready, and then she'd drain them, put in the salt pork and the molasses, and don't ask me why, but she always added a can of Friends beans. So if my grandmother used them, they got to be good beans. So that's why you should try them, because they go into every pot of my grandmother's baked beans. Well, Leonard Patricelli, who was the former chairman of Channel 3, was the program director at the time, and he had the monitor on in his office at night. He was doing some work, and he calls down, and he says, that last guy, what's his name? Brad Davis. That's the guy we're hiring, because he told the truth. And I tell the kids when I go out to speak, if it was Windex, I'd never been here because my grandmother didn't use Windex. So that's how I got the job. For 13 weeks, I was not on staff.
Okay, you weren't a staff announcer.
I wanted to get on staff. Okay. I was in 58. I came there, and I was there for about, well, it was going to be 13 weeks, but the show took right off. So it lasted for 11 years. So that first year, I kept bugging them. I said, you know, I'd like to get on staff. I'd like to be on the announcing staff. So they gave an audition, and part of it was a classical music because I had an FM. And I remember every time I couldn't pronounce one of the names, I'd say Carmen Dragon. And a symphony orchestra. But I finally passed, took it three times, finally passed it, and I was on staff, and that was a big deal for me to have my television show on Saturdays, 5:30, and I would work a 3 to 11 shift on radio, and on Saturday, I would come in and do my show and then work till 1 or 2 in the morning, doing booth work and things like that.
We're going to take you now to another remote point in our complete coverage of the situation of power failure here in the Hartford area. Brad Davis is standing by at the Hartford Electric Light Company headquarters in Wethersfield.
I'm here at Helco with Joe McCormick, Vice President in charge of public relations, and you've had reports on the air, Dick, with other gentlemen concerned with the public utility industry. Joe, just what is the situation as far as Hartford Electric Light is concerned?
I would say the situation at the present time is that we have picked up about two-thirds of our total customers throughout our area. That means that we have practically all of Hartford. We have about half of East Hartford, half of Wethersfield.
The reason I was sent to Helco is I was doing Helco commercials at the time on Channel 3. They had selected me to do their commercials. Yes, I went down there, and Joe McCormick was the fellow that I talked to. He was Vice President of Public Relations and a great guy, and just told the story. Our main purpose, and I think it came through in that broadcast, was to make people, because, you know, people thought maybe a bomb had gone off. They didn't know what happened. And it was just to kind of keep them calm, and that was our purpose of doing that particular broadcast. That was an eventful night.
And the best, there's a meeting here tonight. Yes, it's the
WTIC Hootenanny Road Show with Judy Resnick, the Guardsman, the Grand Ole 26-string band, and in our talent spotlight, the Trade Winds of Guilford with yours truly, Brad Davis. Brought to you by Connecticut Milk for Health and by Sage Allen. Remember, Sage Allen this week is celebrating 75 years of serving you. Wherever you are in Connecticut, there's a Sage Allen stocked with bargains to thank you for 75 years of valued patronage.
There's a grin on every upturned face and a smile in every eye. Come on, the brothers and the sisters, shout, let me hear your joyful cry.
That was created for radio. Dave Wilkinson was the producer of that. And we went to different schools all over the state. And kids would sell tickets, keep the money for some school function, maybe for the yearbook or something. And we did a series of them everywhere. And I used to host them live. We'd go right out and we would broadcast live those shows. And we did a lot of them. I remember the McGowan Brothers with Doug Lapham, and they were a great group. We had a lot of various singers on that show.
Thank you very much. And welcome to the TIC Hootenanny Road Show from the heart of Sinsbury at Henry James Memorial High School. We're out on behalf of the newspaper and the band tonight, and we have 1,000 here in the gym at Henry James Memorial.
It was really great. We'd pack these auditoriums. I mean, and there was nothing like it. I mean, good evening, everybody. Welcome to the Hootenanny Road Show. And, you know, we'd have a theme song, and the kids would be clapping and singing, and we'd get some of this kumbaya stuff going, and Michael wrote a short.
Robert E. Smith.
Bill Hennessy.
Was the music director for WTIC-FM.
Well, Robert E. Smith was kind of our mentor.
Bob Ellsworth.
Because he programmed the FM station.
Robert E. Smith knew more about music than anybody.
Arnold Dean.
He was a musicologist, loved opera, operettas, and saw every show that ever came to Broadway.
It's hard to describe Robert E.
Dick Bertel.
He was not an announcer. His background, he was an A&R man for Victor Records back in the late 20s. That's his claim to fame. And Leonard J. Patricelli met him in New York one time and invited him up to do a program, which he subsequently did, called Your Box at the Opera.
This is Robert E. Smith, and this is our 1204th visit in Your Box at the Opera. The opera world is always on the lookout for and ready to cheer a great coloratura soprano. The royal line of such unique singers has come down to us in our time from Sembrich, Tetrazzini, Melba, Gallicurci, Del Monte, Pagliucci, Pons, Callas, Sutherland.
This was on Sunday afternoons, and he would play these rare 78 records of vocalists, you know, back in 1910 and so forth. You know, it was just a wonderful program, and I enjoyed listening to it.
The program on this visit in your box at the opera was dedicated to one of the finest French opera stars of the past 25 years, Mado Robin.
Then he went on to his own program, which was on, I think, at 10 o'clock in the morning in the late 50s and right through the 70s.
Good morning, friends. This is Robert E. Smith with another Theater of Melody playbill. Songs and singers we shall hear during the next hour on WTIC by way of carefully selected recordings. For the overture today, we have the overture to Redhead. That was a musical that starred Gwen Verdon a few seasons ago. The music is by Dorothy Fields at Albert Haig.
And he would play a lot of musical gems, you know, music from Broadway, current music, and music from the 30s and 40s. And I enjoy. Robert E. Smith was a wonderful guy, one of the funniest men you'd ever want to meet. And, you know, I enjoyed him personally, but I really enjoyed him as a person to listen to. In other words, if I were home, I would tune in his program because I enjoyed his commentary and his music.
Hope you'll join me again Monday morning right here in your Theater of Melody for more music of the theater, which comes to you by way of recordings. This is Robert E. Smith, your host for this hour on TIC. Have a pleasant weekend.
This is Broadcast House in Hartford, WTIC-FM.
Initially, in the 60s and in the early 70s, it was totally committed to the classical format.
Former WTIC sales executive Bob Dunn.
It was something that was very important to the management team, but particularly to Leonard Patricelli. And so there was a dedication to that format and a commitment.
If you are interested in classical guitar, may I suggest that you tune to Dinner Music in Stereo this evening for our final selection, which will come sometime about 23 minutes after 7 o'clock. We'll feature guitarist Alirio Diaz with Vivaldi's Concerto in C Major for guitar and strings. We remind you, too, that the Chicago Symphony will be heard in concert this evening following our program guide at 7:30. In fact, it might be a good idea to stay right where you are, and that's at 96.5 throughout the daylight hours and through the evening for a variety of very fine listening.
In 69, when I got there,
Bill Henry,
and until they changed ownership, it was a mix of sort of light pops. Bob Steele was on AM and FM. And I believe Robert E. Smith then did a sort of light classical show. And then I think they separated somewhere around 11 a.m. FM separated from AM. Stereo Spectacular, yeah.
It's Stereo Spectacular from WTIC-FM in Hartford. 96.5 megacycles on your FM radio dial, and WTIC-FM is now beginning its daily program of music and news. Music of all kinds, beginning with the popular favorites of Stereo Spectacular, Bert Kempfert, Don Costa, and the status symbol, also Herb Rabine.
I was the FM announcer from 11 o'clock in the morning until 6 in the evening.
Lonnie Jerev.
And I ran the board, and it was almost all classical music.
And I think I don't recall whether we continue with the Pops theme or whether we went to the classics. It may have been something like midday classics. It was definitely a mixture of kind of what they might call elevator music and classical music.
The other man's grass is always greener. The Johnny Mann Singers, preceded by the Grenadier Guards Band with John Philip Sousa's El Capitan March. And to close out this edition of Stereo Pops on a Saturday afternoon, we hear once again from the Guitars Unlimited the theme from Black Orpheus. We're next on WTIC-FM in Hartford.
Work of Offenbach. The Philadelphia Orchestra under the baton of Eugene Ormandy play for us from the Gaieté Parisienne, the Peruvian and the Cordettes, and Can Can.
And I want to remind you that this evening another pop concert holds the promise of good listening. Special selections will include The Sorcerer's Apprentice by Dukas, performed by the Paris Conservatory Orchestra, and the presentation of Wagner's Siegfried's Rhine Journey. Hear pop concert at 10 past 8 on WTIC.
Music of the 20th century. You're listening to WTIC-FM at 96.5 megacycles from Hartford, Connecticut.
At the half-hour mark, we break. This is Jazz Time on WTIC-FM in Hartford, 96.5 on your FM set. We're relaxing, playing some of the best in jazz on a winter's night. And here is a giant of the medium, a man named Art Tatum, one of the greatest pianists ever to come down the pike. The late Art Tatum plays Willow Weep for Me, with Bill Evans at the piano, Shelley Mann on drums, and Getting Sentimental Over You. That's it for our get-together for this evening. This is John Burchard. Thanks for joining us. And our engineer, Bob Chirego, thanks you, too. Stay tuned for news, sports, and weather on WTIC. And remember, Jazz Time is on the air Saturday nights at 10 and also Monday nights at 10. Join us either or both times. Good night.
Good evening, and welcome to Starlight Stereo.
Good evening, and we hope you're in a relaxed mood. We have some very nice, relaxing music for you on Starlight Stereo from WTIC-FM.
Yeah, was it Starlight Stereo? Or
something called Starlight Stereo.
Starlight Concert? I don't remember that.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to Starlight Stereo.
Bill Henry inviting you to join me from this point until 1 a.m. because we've got some good music for you. Music to provide a pleasant background. It'll be the songs of Percy Faith.
I mean, I don't remember exactly what the name of that show was, but I do remember doing the program. Sometimes it was the last thing you did at the end of the day. You spent the last couple of hours in FM. That might be from 11:30 till 2 a.m.
Was it tough to market? Yes. You know, call Jerry Franklin and ask him how difficult it is with his public stations here in Connecticut, thus their recent format change to news and talk. But internally, there was a major, major commitment to that format, and there were listeners. There was no question there were dedicated listeners. You had some tremendously professional, well-renowned people. Robert E. Smith, for example, a program on the station that was very, very popular. So I went out and learned how to market that format, and we did develop advertisers over the years. It never did as well as anyone would have liked it to financially because it has a limited appeal. You don't have the mass numbers. You have a very dedicated, loyal audience, so you have to find a certain advertiser.
Art Johnson with you here on the other side of the day on WTIC.
Art Johnson was a younger addition to the staff.
Bob Ellsworth.
And a very knowledgeable musical person. In other words, your top quality DJ.
When was the last time you heard that one? Jumping with Symphony Sid. My goodness, does that bring back memories. It goes back to the Birdland era, one that I remember, possibly you do too. I'm trying to think of some of the sidemen that may have been on that set. I was wondering if it was Chuck Wayne on guitar, or Levi Jackson on bass, Terrence Gubenko on vibes, Terry Gibbs, and a few others. He's had a lot of sidemen down through the years.
He had been at WDRC, Arthur Nelson Johnson Jr.
Bill Hennessy.
And he was a good straight announcer.
When TIC finally came off the 19 hours or whatever the FCC gave us in the old days, I don't know, I forget what the broadcast day was. We would bring it to an end with the national anthem. Went 24 hours, and Art did the overnight show. He was hired to do that because he had a collection of his own music as well as the vast musical resources of TIC library. So he became the music till dawn guy, you might say. His ambition always was to one day somehow get into the satellite of WNEW in New York, because that was his, as it was to many of us, a great desire to be a part of.
Have you looked into clock radios? I'll get back to that in just a second. But sometimes they'll set it for like 25 of 5 or 20 of 5 or something like that to allow them a little time to sort of lounge around 10, 15 minutes. That's very luxurious sleep, or semi-sleep time. If you have one of those little gizmos, you know, you hit the button and the alarm goes off in another 10 minutes or something like that. That's beautiful sleep. I'd love that. Stolen sleep. Marvelous.
Usually about the time as I was about ready to leave,
Bill Henry,
or my last hour or two there, Art would come in to do the other side of the day. And he was a terrific guy. Very hip, very intelligent, and a perfect overnight guy.
He worked that overnight shift, and consequently,
Arnold Dean,
he kind of liked it when it was quiet at the station. It was him and an engineer, and that was it.
That was Henry Mancini in the Pink Panther theme, and that wraps things up this morning here on the other side of the day. Arthur Nelson Johnson Jr. on this side of things. Mention yourself first. Always get that plug in right. Thank you, Fred Pearson. Good job, lad. What can I tell you? And we'll catch up with you on Sunday evening, along about 11:30. I understand you have a very exciting weekend going for you. It sounds, we can't say anything about it now, but it is an enormously exciting weekend coming up. And I hope everything turns out splendidly, okay? Enjoy.
My shift was Tuesdays and Wednesdays off.
Fred Pearson.
11 at night to 7 in the morning, and I supported Arthur Nelson Johnson Jr. on the overnight show. And on his days off, it was Paul Sutton that did that show.
He always looked forward to Bob Steele coming in the morning. The two of them might sit and play cards sometimes at the desk because nobody else was in yet.
And the time is 8.5 minutes before the hour. 8.5 minutes before 5 o'clock in the morning.
That is correct.
What are
eight
you doing up so early in the morning?
Eight minutes before five. I'm just warming up for the a little show that starts at 6 o'clock there. Good morning, Arthur.
Good morning.
I'm not supposed to be on your show, but
I know. We don't care.
I can't afford to pay anything for this, that's you understand
right.
That.
That's all right. Now, well, just tell me what you're doing.
What do you get for a five-minute announcement on this show? No, well, I couldn't sleep. That's the only reason.
What are you carrying in your pockets? I'll take anything you got.
I can't. I just couldn't sleep bad enough one of those nights.
You're kind of restless, is that it?
Yeah.
Steele, as you know, couldn't sleep very well, and sometimes he'd wake up at 3 a.m., or never sleep, you know, be up at 3 a.m. and drive to New Haven for a cup of coffee. And other times he would just go in and hang out with Art at the station.
So I worked the overnight shift many times with Art Johnson. Knew him well, liked him a lot.
Bill Flower.
Art was a very good guy, had a great sense of humor, and I especially liked the music he played.
The song from Moulin Rouge, The Cascading Voices, here on the other side of the day. Hey, listen, by the way, if you should hear from time to time some maniacal screaming and yelling and pounding on the studio windows and like that, try to pay it no mind. Really, seriously. Newsman Bill Flower is trying to give up cigarettes. And I've been taunting him just a little bit, you know. Inquiring if he has one with him or something like that and so on. I didn't find this out until just a short while ago, so actually I haven't been nudging him too much about it, but it's funny. It's funny. I think it's about as funny as falling down a flight of stairs when you first start something like this.
When I was on with Art, I kept the speaker up and I listened to his show and enjoyed listening to his show. And on a relatively slow night on the WTIC overnight shift, it was not unusual at all for me to have 3-4 hours worth of newscasts lined up and all done by 2 o'clock in the morning, and able to sit back and listen to the show and listen to the police scanner and read the current when the first edition first came in and got a chance to hear the show. On a busier night, I didn't have that luxury.
Call it 19 minutes before 3 o'clock on a Thursday morning. I'm not sure what's happening outside just now. I haven't bothered to look. I usually don't get too terribly enthusiastic about little canned goodies that they have in the cast iron commissary down below, but they have this one combination they kind of like. Shouldn't mention them, because every time I mention something I like, it either vanishes or everybody takes it before I can get to it. This is the spaghetti with the sauce and the sliced frankfurters. Not bad at all, really. Of course, my tastes are kind of weird anyway. But this is pretty good. You're probably lying there, thinking to yourself, what's in the refrigerator, right? I bet you that if it's at the Lamb household, Morris will beat you to the refrigerator every time. Does your cat react to the opening of the refrigerator door? Like greased lightning, huh?
And 3 to 3:30 in the morning every night was our lunch, so to speak. And when Art got in first thing in the evening, he would sit down and record a voice track introducing songs and then doing the outros. And the engineer that was going to leave at 11:30 at night would take that voice track and mix a half-hour show together that we'd play back in the air from 3 to 3:30. So that's sort of when we took our break. We sort of still hung around in the studio area because we were on the air. But that gave us a half an hour every night just to sit back. And usually it was a big classical piece.
Elegy from Serenade in C Major, Opus 48 by Tchaikovsky, the London Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Sir John Barbirolli. This is Sir Arthur of Broadcast House, I guess. I don't know what else to say, actually. I don't have anything terribly clever in my mind right now. Sirloin of beef, cirrhosis of liver.
But Art, I thought, was perfect for that show. And he dressed like most of us didn't dress that well during the daytime, although we did wear shirts, ties, and coats. And he would dress up. I mean, he was sparkling when he walked in there.
Very well dressed, even for the midnight show. He'd come in with a tie and a suit.
Dick Zwerko.
Always well pressed. Just the hair just groomed just right, as if he was on TV. And he very a stickler for dressing, for being well dressed.
But he had a following and an audience and just was a total class act.
Art Johnson, of course, has passed away.
People like Art Johnson just aren't around anymore.
In 1953, the Weather Bureau had been in downtown Hartford, and they were going to move out to Bradley Field.
Charlie Bagley.
The Weather Bureau people had been doing the reports on WTIC radio, as still happens in some places, but Travel Zone, of course, WTIC. They felt they were losing something, and they had a lot of reasons why they wanted to start their own weather service. One thing, they wanted to do a lot of work in crop hail damage and things like that, insurance-related events. And what they did is they hired probably the top meteorologist in the country, a guy named named Dr. Tom Malone. They hired him away from MIT to come down and set up the Stradlers Weather Service. Tom came down and he brought some very smart people with him, and they started this group. It was one of the very few private weather services in the country. There were a few around, but Travelers really had the cream of the crop of people. Yeah, I became director in 1970, and we had 10 meteorologists at the time. Well, we had Jim McDonald.
So we look for mostly sunny skies, breezy and cold today, temperatures in the upper 30s and low 40s. Fair and cold tonight, lows in the teens and 20s. Tomorrow, sunny in the morning, increasing clouds in the afternoon, continued cold. That's the weather story. This is Jim McDonald.
Jim was the oldest in the service, not necessarily in age, but oldest in service. Jim had his master's in meteorology from MIT. We had Ken Gary, we had John Erickson.
Across Connecticut and western Massachusetts, a chance of a few isolated snow flurries this afternoon, nothing important. Down along the shoreline, though, it is snowing at most spots down there now, but the snow will be ending over the next few hours.
We had Bill Mammon, Jerry Wilson, Barbara Allen, who recently passed away.
Now the latest forecast from the Travelers Weather Service in Hartford, your forecaster, Barbara Allen.
Good evening, everyone. That strong and potent storm off to our south has not yet made much of a move in our direction.
We had Milt Barlow.
The Travelers Weather Service, and here is Milt Barlow with that weather word, Milt.
For Connecticut and western Massachusetts, periods of snow through the night with some rain in coastal areas. Temperatures in the 30s. Through the day Thursday, a mixture of snow and rain. Mostly snow in northwestern Connecticut and western Massachusetts. Highs 35 to 40. Rain and snow ending Thursday night with partly cloudy skies and cold by Friday morning. Friday mostly sunny and cold. It's 37 now in Hartford.
Now, Barbara and Milt had both worked for the Weather Bureau, and Travelers hired them away when they started to run their own weather service. Like, people always said, what was the worst weather you can remember? And I'd say the time we missed the forecast. They had the capability and the luxury of any time there was severe weather, we could go on the air immediately. And the setup was, if we called and said, we want to go on the air, there was no argument. They would clean everything out for us to go right on. I did the weather on Steele's program for 12 years.
And now let's look at the weather.
The WTIC Travelers Weather Service forecast for southern New England. A rainy Monday. The National Weather Service has issued a stream and flood watch for this afternoon and for this evening for western and central southern New England. The computers indicate it's possible we get close to 2 inches of rain, and that will become heavy at times this afternoon. Our temperature's in the 40s. Overnight, the rain tapering off to scattered showers with readings of 35 to 40. And for tomorrow, a breezy, cool day, there'll still be a chance for a few scattered showers, possibly even a few snow showers in the hills. Right now in Hartford, it's 41.
41, thank you, Charlie.
I did it from 1972 to 1984, and they wanted me full-time, and I said, I can't do that. My job is to run the weather service. So we finally made the deal that if I was in town, I would do Steele's programs in the morning.
Broadcasting as a community service of the University of Hartford, this is WWUH West Hartford, WAPJ Torrington, WDJW Summers, and WWEB Wallingford. And now back to Connecticut Radio Memories. Former WTIC engineer, Dick Swerko.
Actually, Frank Atwood started the show. And
Frank Atwood, your neighbor down the road at Hartford, Wednesday, June 4. Delightful morning.
Frank Atwood.
Chuck Albert.
Frank Atwood was the early morning man. He talked to the farmers all the time.
In the Hartford County 4-H Club Fair catalog.
Oh, he was just a nice, down-to-earth, smart man.
Longtime WTIC receptionist, Kay Mahoney.
He knew everything. He was affiliated originally with the University of Connecticut, and I guess that's how he happened to, you know, arrive at WTIC.
Frank.
Bob Ellsworth.
A dear man, just so knowledgeable about farm matters, both commercially and agriculturally, because he could talk on any subject, and he had many great guests. Whatever passed through his program in the early morning hours was just truth itself, you know, the knowledge of Connecticut agriculture and agronomy. And he was wonderful at it, but natural. He was just, I guess, as he was billed, your neighbor down the road.
And the weather report from the Travelers Weather Service brings us along up to our sign-off time. Portions of this program pre-recorded. This is Frank Atwood, your neighbor down the road. Mike Russell, our engineer. WTIC, AM and FM Hartford, your station for the Republican National Convention. Bob Steele now, 6 o'clock.
Don Tuttle did the farm show for a while then.
Don Tuttle's coming along at 5 o'clock.
Well, good morning, Arthur.
Morning.
I trust that you won't hide the studio on me this morning. It was very difficult yesterday. I just barely got on the air on time. You know, when you move the studio from the third floor to the first floor, it really mixes me up. In fact, as you well know, it doesn't take very much to mix me up at this hour of the morning. But I'll try to get straightened out by 5 o'clock so we can relieve you on Town and Country. And we'll have some market news, agricultural headline stories, some good wake-up music. And we'll have two reports, one out of the USDA and a resource report from the Connecticut Agricultural Experiment Station. See you later.
Of course, Bill Cleed from 70 to about 76 at WTIC Outdoors.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to God's Country. This is WTIC Outdoors, Bill Cleed on this side of the microphone. Frederick Ambrose Pearson III doing the technical side. We'll be with you for the next 54 minutes with live reports and recorded reports, lots of news information, weather, and some good music. And to start us off, Floyd Kramer on the piano and Last Date.
Bill Cleed came from the Hartford Times, and so he adorned the TIC ground with his own professional presence and added a great deal of update to it in his general knowledge, which covered many fields from his journalism and newspaper days. So he brought the ink to the electronics.
Well, I actually applied in 1964, but they never had an opening until 1965. And Ross Miller then contacted me and said, are you still interested? And I said, absolutely. And I came and passed their audition.
Talk about the audition a little bit. I heard that was a pretty rigorous process.
Oh, that's a monster. I tell you, if you took all the announcers who are on the air today and made them pass that audition, I'll bet 99% would not make it. What they did was, people like Bob Steele, I think, helped them out. Geographical pronunciations. They took probably the 60 or 70 most unpronounceable or frequently mispronounced places on the face of the earth. They were all on that sheet. They did the same with all of the musical names, classical music. They did the same thing with how you interpret news, how you deliver a commercial. It was really an exhaustive process. Then, after that tape was completed, they put you on the TV set and had you first ad-lib 1 minute about your background. I'll tell you an interesting story about that, too. They said, ad-lib your background for 1 minute. And I said, okay, and I waited, and they gave me the cue. And I started off with my name, my age, my hometown, my interest in broadcasting. And about 30 seconds into it, judging as carefully as I could, they said, oh, wait a minute, the tape wasn't rolling. Hold on. And they said, we'll start over. And they cued me again. And through my evil little mind, I'm thinking, you know what? I think the tape was running, and they want to see how well prepared I was and if I'm going to do the same thing. So I quickly did it from completely another direction, ad-libbed a completely different background. I think that, too, was part of the audition. And then to do a newscast with no teleprompter or anything, you had the sheet in front of you. Okay, here, sell this newscast to us. And so on.
Things
and
like
then
that.
They met you in a social situation where they would take you out to lunch and, you know, just talk to you and see what kind of a person you were. And there were about maybe 8 executives, all of whom had to say, yes, I have no problem with him, before you were hired. And the nicest thing happened that day. The last of my interviews was with the late Leonard J. Patricelli. He said, Arnold, if you like us and we like you as a result of this meeting today, then we hope this is the last time in your life you'll ever look for another job. We had 19 staff announcers when I joined.
It's really almost like a network type situation.
Much larger than the networks, yeah. Actually. And that doesn't include Bob Steele, who was chief announcer, Gene Colbert, who was women's editor, musicologist Robert E. Smith, Frank Atwood, who was the farm director, Bill Cleed, who was the outdoor editor, George Ehrlich, who was the sports director, yeah. Plus 19 announcers. When I joined the radio station, Bill Hennessy was doing a program called Hennessy, That's Me. And when Constitution Plaza, which had just been built, this is mid-60s, it was only about 2 years old, and to show off that beautiful plaza, which also belonged to the Travelers, they decided they would do a noontime program on the plaza.
Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to the Plaza Show. This is Arnold Dean, and today something very special for you, the 3rd Naval District Staff Band Live.
We had visitors out there from all over the world all the time. So you could do a man in the street type thing and play records as well. And the records turned out to be big band recordings.
So was it outside?
They did the program outside, weather permitting. And you'd find visitors from China and Japan and Thailand and, you know, Germany and Sweden, every place, walking around, taking pictures, looking at this wonderful answer to the problem of urban decay. And Hennessy left 1 year later, and typically of WTIC, they held an audition. They had five or six different announcers did the program for 1 week, one after another, and at the end of that time, they said, okay, we like the job Arnold Dean did, and I was privileged to get it, which led to a whole career outside of the sport.
And that wraps it up on the Plaza Show for today, a very special day for us. Our thanks to all our guests, and especially to Petty Officer Vic Swanson and members of the 3rd Naval District Staff Band, to Brian Hartnett, who produced today's program, with engineering by Bob Schirago. We'll see you again tomorrow afternoon with another recorded session at 12:25. This is Arnold Dean on the Plaza Show, and you are tuned to 1080 Radio. This is WTIC in Hartford, Connecticut.
That program ultimately disappeared, and it was Bob Steele in the morning, and then Dick Bertel did a 10-2 program, and Lou Palmer did 2-6. So there was no room in there for the Plaza program anymore, but there was an hour at night when I was normally working anyway.
Welcome to the Big Band Sounds of the Dean's List. My name is Arnold Dean. We begin with Duke Ellington's great orchestra.
And that's where the Dean's List came on, again, based on big band recordings.
And he also did a monthly special from the
Bob Schirago,
I guess early 70s, for about 5 years, monthly special interviewing big band personalities and playing their music. And he and I recorded a lot of those programs on location. We would record interviews with people and then come back and produce the programs.
Music, people don't understand this. It's a very difficult thing. Everybody associates playing music with proficiency, techniques. It has nothing to do with that. I mean, that's very secondary. What's most important in playing music is the set of ears you develop. If what you hear inside your head is very, very good, you will spend your life and all of your efforts trying to duplicate that sound. You'll never do it, but you'll at least try to approximate it. And if you keep sharpening your hearing, what you do will get better, because you'll force yourself to. You won't be able to stand being worse than that sound. I mean, imagine how well Heifetz hears. When we hear what he does, he can't do what he really hears. Mm-hmm. Nobody can, but he hears awfully good. So that's what it's about.
That's the voice of Artie Shaw, one of the most colorful and successful of all the big band leaders, and certainly one of the most controversial. Artie Shaw, the man and the music, our guest tonight on a one-night stand with the big bands. This is Arnold Dean, and our program...
Of all that I've ever done, that was the big one for me. My favorite musician was Artie Shaw, and so I tried to get him on the air, and I tried and tried, and I think finally to get rid of me, he made an appointment with me, and I went to his office apartment, which was on Fifth Avenue in New York, and we talked. We walked in, and I could hear him screaming at somebody on the telephone, while his secretary, who was a nervous wreck, she was terrified of him, you could tell, tried to say, "Mr. Shaw's not in a very good mood today. I hope he'll be all right." And then when we walked in, he slammed the phone down. I tried to introduce myself, and he said, "Yeah, how long is this going to take?" And I figured, boy, we're off to a wonderful start here. We started the interview. I started off by saying, "You were born Arthur Arshawski in New Haven, Connecticut on such and such a date." And I looked at him, silence. I said, "Am I right so far?" And he said, "Yes, I have no idea what that has to do with anything, but it is correct." And then we went on from there, and I kind of really surprised him because he didn't know I had studied his life. He wrote a book called The Trouble with Cinderella. I'd read it three times. I had made notes about what was recorded when, what the circumstances were. And then when I'd ask him about particular things that nobody else remembered, he'd say, "Well, no, Frenesy was recorded after that Mexican trip." And I'd say, "Well, not quite, Artie. The Mexican trip was on such and such dates. You recorded Frenesy on such and such dates." And he was astounded at the things that he had forgotten. We had three half-hour hour tapes, and my feeling was, we'll be lucky if we get half of one tape, and I'll try to make it last for one show. We were getting perilously close to the end of the third tape, and I had to put a finish to the show to get some kind of completion on it, and I don't know how much longer he would have gone, but we did the closing, and while Ted was packing up the equipment, Shaw put his arm around me and said, come here, I want to show you something. He took me into a hallway and showed me the 8 gold records for Stardust, Frenzy, and so on, Begin the Begin, his other great hits. And then he said, I think he wanted to do this privately, he said, by the way, there were many things that came out in that interview that I had completely forgotten. I would like copies of those tapes, if you don't mind. So, and I figured, boy, this is a golden achievement here today. And he mentioned that he had a home in Lakeville, and he said, I'd love to see you out there someday. But unfortunately, you know, we never got together again, but I was really happy with that.
And that's it, friends, for the Dean's List for tonight, and I'm afraid forever. Although I like that title, we may come up with another program for it one of these days. Remember now, although we will no longer be on the air with this show, I'll be looking for you weeknights at about 6:15 with Sports and Sports Talk. You'll be able to give us a call and converse a bit.
They decided to go with the news talk approach, particularly at night. As I mentioned, Lou Palmer was on 2 to 6, and so the talk evening was not going to begin till 7, and I could see a little hole in the schedule there, so I approached them on the idea of doing a sports talk show. I know I'm not the first. Lou Palmer wanted to do one. George Ehrlich for years wanted to have one, and it was never done, but here, suddenly, there was a need to fill about a 45-minute block anyway, and they decided to give it a shot.
Next, talk sports with Arnold Dean.
Arnold Dean, Sports Talk.
WTIC 1080 invites you to talk sports with Arnold Dean. Dial the Dean of Sports at 522-0200.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome. We'll be here until 8 o'clock tonight.
And here we are 40 years later, and the program is still going, or actually 30 years, 1976.
All these years you've been doing the sports talk, and you've interviewed, I'd say hundreds, but it's probably in the thousands, I think.
I wish I could even count. Yeah. I wish I had kept a log.
Are there some interviews that stand out? Can you choose two or three that you won't forget?
I'll give you one that I certainly won't forget. That was Ted Williams. He was going to be appearing in the fishing show at the Hartford Civic Center. So about a month before he was to come, as soon as I heard he was coming, I called the promoter and I said, how would you like 1 hour of free airtime on WTIC advertising the fishing show? He said, are you kidding? You know what that would cost? It's, you know, many thousands. And I said, all you have to do is get me Ted Williams in the studio to do sports talk the night before he opens. And he said, I'll work on it. He told me a week before the show he's going to do it. And I was so terrified that he wouldn't show up. And I thought, this is going to be a real black eye. So I would kind of say, next Tuesday, Ted Williams is going to be our guest. You know, just kind of, you didn't really hear that, but I want you to know that. Yeah, I have mixed emotions.
Ted, it's good to see you. You look great.
Thank you. I've been to the Red Sox, as you know, for the last 10 days. And I have a chance to come up and follow Lefty's act up here in Hartford. Tough act to follow, for sure.
Well, you look terrific. How do the Red Sox look? I haven't been to camp yet.
Yeah, you know, I heard somebody say the other day that the odds on Detroit were 2-1 or something. The odds on Baltimore, 5-1. The odds on Toronto, 3-1. The odds on Baltimore, 10-1. The odds on the Red Sox, 25-1.
Yep.
I'm not really a betting man on baseball, but I want to tell you something. The Red Sox got a pretty good ball club. And at home, they got one of the best hitting clubs that any club has at home. And if their young pitching comes through, they're going to be a surprise.
But sure enough, he showed up that night, sat in the studio for the whole hour, and that's a fantastic show.
Presenting Bob Steele and Strictly Sports.
Howdy, sports fans and everybody. How are you tonight? Greetings from Studebaker, pioneer and pacemaker in automotive progress. The winner tonight will be Peralta, Peralta, Peralta. I repeat the name 3 times to be sure that you know I'm picking Peralta. After he wins, I don't want people saying to me, why didn't you pick Peralta?
Join George Ehrlich and me tomorrow night at 8:05 here on TIC for the UConn-Holy Cross basketball game, and I'll be with you again on Sports Final on Thursday at 11:25. This is Floyd Richards.
It's time for sports, and here's Scott Gray. Good morning, Scott.
Good morning, Bob. Good morning, everyone. The Whalers tied the Flames at 2. The Flames had been trailing 2-0 before knotting it up. In the United States Football League, Tampa Bay down Jersey 32-9, Boston 19, Washington 6.
Most other places have one guy doing sports. We had three at any given time.
Hi, everyone. This is George Ehrlich, transcribed with tonight's edition of Strictly Sports.
Actually, when I came here in 1965, that was Bob Steele's show. Bob would work his morning show, then he would come back in the afternoon, and George Ehrlich would have written the television sports. What they do is at 6 o'clock, I think they did weather. At 6:05, they did Close Up on Sports with Bob Steele, and the script was by George Ehrlich. And then he would go upstairs, and from 6:25 to 6:35, he would do Strictly Sports, 10 minutes on radio, again prepared by George. Then, when Bob couldn't be there, was on vacation or whatever, George would take over on the air. George also did the two shows on Saturdays. When Bob Steele decided around 1966 or so, I'm tired of coming back in the afternoon, the morning show is enough, then Ehrlich was given those two shows, and I started doing the show on Saturday.
George Ehrlich, Wayne Mulligan.
I thought he was a great sportscaster and a great play-by-play man back when he was doing UConn.
George Ehrlich came over from WHAY to be the voice of UConn.
Bill Hennessy.
Which he'd already been, but TIC had picked up the UConn games on radio for broadcasting basketball, and George came with the package.
Oh, yeah. I knew George well.
Wayne Norman.
I never did a game with him, but I did games that he was at. I did games he broadcast. I did games he attended, and he was one of the best. Ehrlich was so unique in what he did. He had a staccato type of delivery, and he could describe all the action.
Bradley, double team, holds the ball, stolen by Pernell. Dom Pernell steals with 18 seconds from Bradley. Pernell dribbles right, holds the ball in the corner, Della Sala, 14 seconds. Pernell to Slumsensky, 10 seconds to go. In the corner, Kimball. Kimball in the corner. Clears it out to Slumsensky, 7 seconds, 6 seconds. Della Sala has the ball, beats to Pernell with 3 seconds. Who shoots? No good, the rebound. There's the gun. UConn has won 52-50. The Huskies go into the finals of the East. Wow.
He had a color man. The guy that I knew back in those days was Floyd Richards, but he had a few guys he worked with, but George was such a dominant personality doing the games that he didn't really need one. So, yeah, he was pretty much anointed with the title of, you know, the voice of UConn basketball. He did football, too, but I think basketball is what he was more known for. And like the Calhoun years, UConn basketball was a religion in the state back in the days when Ehrlich was doing the games. They had some pretty good teams.
I was a student at Georgetown University Law Center.
Dan Bloom.
And at that time, we had no internet. We had very little radio coverage, and I've always been a totally dedicated UConn Husky fan. I mean, you know, you never forget your blues. Well, it happened that the only place in the D.C. area that I could get a good signal to hear the UConn basketball games was a parking lot near the Pentagon. So when there was a really big game, I would drive over to this parking lot and position my car in the appropriate way, and I'd get the game. Well, I did this about three or four times. The fifth time I'm listening, I think it was UMass and UConn. It was a real hotly contested game. All of a sudden, my car is surrounded by soldiers with rifles. And they drag me out of there and bring me into the Pentagon. I'm in an interrogation room. And the guy said, "We've been watching you. We don't like people who come here and stay in the parking lot. We want to know, what are you doing here?" I explained to him, I was listening to the UConn basketball broadcast. This major said to me, "Yeah, I've heard weird excuses in my life before, but you take the cake."
Well, it was amazing because it was a 50,000-watt station, and we knew the imprint of the station was dramatic across Connecticut. We had the Boston Red Sox. Certainly the Red Sox were very important.
The nearest guess I can think of is that it happened sometime in the 50s. We would carry weekend games. And then it evolved, and I know by the mid-60s, 1965, when I came here, we were carrying all the games. No other station has carried them for anywhere near that length of time. And the importance of that station, our wonderful friend, the late Ken Coleman, who called the Red Sox games, never hesitated to say that WTIC was delivering 50% of the entire Red Sox audience. From a network that had 30 or 40 stations, 50% of the total audience came from WTIC. I know that when I left Syracuse, there were several people at the station that I left who were envious, saying, "You're going to the station that carries the Red Sox games." I said, "Boost the power just one more watt, will you?" Because we have trouble getting it on stormy nights. when he owned the team, Tom Yawkey and his summer home in South Carolina listened to them on WTIC. Yeah, because they didn't have television then.
Right.
There was no Nesson, there was no Jerry Remy. And...
Well, I was fortunate in that I became the public address announcer for the Hartford Whalers.
Greg Gilmartin.
And that was an 18-year semi-career that was interesting and ran parallel to my involvement with WTIC and then went well beyond after I had left TIC. So as far as the Hartford Whalers were concerned, that was a part of my life that I'll cherish forever. They were such an important part of the Connecticut sports scene and a very important part of my life. And to be able, for the first few years anyway, to be able to both announce and report on the games, had incredible access and had an understanding of the players. And, you know, they were friends of mine and people you'd hang out with after the games. And that was very good. That was very interesting. And we are so emotionally involved more than, you know, just a reporter covering a story. There was a definite emotional connection. And I think a lot of that still survives today.
The New England Whalers begin their regular season of play in the newly reshuffled World Hockey Association tonight at Edmonton. And you'll hear all 80 games this season live on WTIC 1080. Each broadcast will be preceded by the Blue Line telephone show. It all begins tonight, 9:35 airtime, the New England Whalers at Edmonton on WTIC 1080.
And I often said that one of the best days of my life was when the team came here, and the worst day was when the team left.
One group of people behind the scenes that we often don't hear about are the engineers.
As the technical caretakers of these facilities, we share stories and swap horror stories in and amongst ourselves, but you know, the public rarely ever gets to hear.
WTIC Chief Engineer Jeff Hugabon.
WTIC is certainly a prominent signal on the dial during the daytime, but at nighttime, I do routinely get reception reports, you know, legitimate DX from outside the borders of the United States. Typically, we are received in all of the Scandinavia countries. I mean, for instance, I get a reception report, especially in the wintertime months, about every week from Finland. The facility was essentially more or less built to service the better part of the East Coast. So our typical standard night service extends from about the northern tip of Maine up into the Canadian Maritimes with a pretty darn well receivable signal down to a little south of Virginia, you know, getting it tickling into the Carolinas a little bit. It kind of fades out with some interference when you get much further south than that. And then out into probably eastern Ohio before you start to really run into some significant interference at the edge of our coverage area. But, you know, for instance, WTIC is the local affiliate for Red Sox in Rochester.
In a 1960 WTIC anniversary program, Supervisor of Engineering Herman Taylor discussed the construction of WTIC.
I started the station with my predecessor, Mr. Randall, who of course has since passed away, but I have participated in all of the installations, the studios, transmitters.
The engineering staff was huge.
Former engineer Fred Pearson.
We had studio broadcast engineers for radio, there was television engineers, there was cameramen, there was a maintenance engineering staff.
Yeah, we had an engineering staff of 40 people.
Former engineer Wayne Mulligan.
There were 20 engineers in television, there were 10 in radio, and 10 at the mountain at the transmitting facility.
When I first came on in broadcasting at WTIC.
Former engineer Dick Zwerko.
You had to read the meters at the transmitter. First it was hourly, and then every 3 hours, then every 6 hours, and once a day. You have to read the various plate and voltage meters, and also the current. You have to go to the base of the towers and read the tower meters, and that was real fun in the snowy days, having to go out into Avon, Connecticut, in the top of Avon Mountain. We even had snowshoes to put on if it really was, and there were times we had to do that to get to the towers to read the meters. Do that at least once a day for a while. Then the FCC relaxed the rules, and we then had a remote way of reading the meters in the Hartford studios.
But it was amazing the level of professionalism. You know, one of the things that was always required when I was there was the engineers had to come in with a jacket and a tie every day. I mean, you came into that building, and that's the way you were dressed. Well, Harold Dorscher was the director of engineering when I was there. Yeah, Harold actually came to Hartford as the chief engineer over at Channel 18. CBS owned Channel 18 in the early days. And he came up with the CBS contingent to Channel 18. And then I believe it was 1957 when the TIC TV went on the air and CBS affiliation moved over to there and CBS shut down 18 and everybody moved over to Channel 3 at that point. So Harold was the chief engineer at the time.
Yeah, Harold Dorshug was my boss, quite a guy.
Dick Zwirko.
He was very knowledgeable, very well respected in the broadcast engineering field, really knew his radio and TV. He retired from WTIC in the mid-70s, I believe. I became engineer in charge. He was chief engineer, but I was doing all the work of the chief engineer, but he had the title. As far as the FCC record, I was the engineer on record for the AM, the FM sites until, I believe, around late 70s when a new engineer came on, Larry Titus, and was with TIC for quite a few years into the 80s before he left on his own.
Former WTIC chief engineer, Larry Titus.
I was 11 years there. I was the fourth chief engineer of WTIC. Harold had the title for like 20-some-odd years. In those days, very specifically, we were off the air for no matter what period of time. If we were off the air, if we even a little pop or whatever, you had to write a 2- or 3-page dissertation on what happened, why it happened, the duration of the outage, and what steps you took to make sure it would not happen again.
One of the primary missions of WTIC is to always maintain that signal and to always be there as a vital facility in New England's emergency communications infrastructure. Thinking back through the historical files and from some of the stories from engineers past, certainly the natural disasters through the station's history, the hurricanes, floods, you know, each of those has its own story.
In a WTIC 40th anniversary broadcast during the 1960s, Supervisor of Engineering Al Jackson recalled the 1936 flood.
We used our battery-operated remote amplifier because all our AC-operated equipment was dead because the Dutch Point power station had gone out. It was completely surrounded by water, as a matter of fact.
Paul Morency.
The 38 hurricane blew down some of our wire to the mountain. But we got back on, I think, in about 22 or 28 minutes. And then we stayed on for about 5 days, day and night. But I remember over in the sixth floor of Grove Street there, some of our boys had to carry batteries up 6 flights in order to get enough power to drive our studio equipment.
Another engineering challenge occurs when the radio station moves locations. When a station physically moves from one part of the city to another, it's necessary to keep facilities active in both locations until a proper cutover can be made. Former WTIC engineer John Reno describes the cutover from the Travelers Grove Street building to the newly constructed broadcast house at Constitution Plaza.
The switchover occurred in 1961, and we actually had studio running up at Grove Street and then turned the switch down at Constitution Plaza, and the radio was activated at that time and also television.
A most important evening in the history of WTIC and its offspring, WTIC FM and TV. This is a time of renewal, a time of thanksgiving, and a time of rededication. Broadcast House, this new 4-story home for our 3 stations, is the first unit to be completed and occupied in Constitution Plaza, an urban renewal which boldly foretells a bright future for Hartford.
TIC did it right. In our broadcast house studios, there was, in the basement, there was a generator, and the generator was very reliable. It was tested on a regular basis, and I can remember there was a power failure in the 1960s, I think it was 65, in November, when the whole Northeast lost power, and within a fraction of a minute, the power generator came on at broadcast house, and we continued on our way. At the transmitter side is a huge diesel generator, which came on, and that continued powering up. So we were on the air, and unless you had the radio and TV on, you wouldn't know that he really lost power, except for that momentary until the generator came on.
Engineers may even face danger in trying to keep their facilities on air 24 hours a day.
And we'd still have to, once a week, go there and do our preventive maintenance. And, of course, you know, when that was done, it wasn't done in the middle of the daytime.
Yeah, you do it at, like, 3 in the morning,
yeah, exactly,
right?
Exactly, you know, and here you are half awake and working with the thousands of volts, and I'm still alive, but there are some times that you sort of wonder, how did I make it?
In the 80s at WTIC is when we had, I was up at the transmitter at the time, filling in for one of the engineers that was supposed to be on duty, and all of a sudden, tremendous amounts of smoke and oil fumes and whatnot come rolling up from the basement, and the generator at the transmitter blew a camshaft or something in the engine, and it started to burn oil and spread fumes throughout the whole place, and parts of the engine were flying all over. It was scary. I thought the whole engine was going to burst into flames. flames and burned the whole building down. But ran downstairs with fire extinguishers, and actually there wasn't any flame, but it was just oil and smoke, and we couldn't stop the engine. It wouldn't turn off. The engine was stopped, actually, by turning the fuel supply off from outside. And that was one of the scariest moments that I ever had. So radio went off for a while, but then actually the power came back on, so it continued. There wasn't much outage at that particular time.
Yeah, we're a 24/7 operation, and therefore the engineering support and the technical support for the facility is also 24/7. That just comes with the job.
I think the pranks came from the fact that we really felt like a family.
Former WTIC engineer Fred Pearson.
You know, it was more like a bunch of brothers and sisters and uncles and aunts and things like that. Of course, you know, the management above you totally respect it, but down on our level, I think the pranks were a way to relieve the tension, but it was a way we sort of played with each other.
Back then, you know, they didn't want you to fool around too much.
Bill Henry.
And so I'm not sure what that did, that caused the announcer to be a little tenser, yeah, a little more aware of these kinds of things, and consequently, for whatever reason, you laughed.
You had to break the tension,
I guess. You broke the tension, yeah, by laughing, and it didn't take much to get you going sometimes.
Bob Steele had a thing where he'd like to break you up.
Arnold Dean.
The thing always was, don't break up on the air. We are very serious here. But then everybody would try to break everybody else up. Bob's favorite thing was, if you were the booth announcer and you had to read a live one-minute commercial, what he would like to do is to do a joke, then point to you as soon as the punchline came, and you had to control yourself if it happened to strike you funny. And this one time, I'll tell you the one that got me. You may not even think it's amusing, but it got me royally. He said, fellas standing before the firing squad. Commandant walks over, says, do you have any last requests? And the man spits in his face. The commandant says, hey, are you looking for trouble? He signaled me. I turned on the mic and I started to say, if you're looking for a real bargain in a used car, but that was as far as I got. I broke up completely. I made Bob's day. He was so happy at that. Yeah, I got Dean today.
I was sitting in the studio once and Arnold Dean was doing the sports. I think I closed out the weather forecast. Next forecast coming up at 11:15 tonight. And Arnold then went into his sportscast, and this is on the radio. And as Arnold started reading the sports, there was an engineer there named Bob Schirago.
Bob Schirago.
Oh, you're not talking about the time that I went into the studio while he was doing a newscast, opened an umbrella, held it over his head, and then poured a glass of water over it.
It pretty much missed Arnold, but it was, you know, just covered the table. Arnold didn't miss a beat. He looked up for a moment, but then just kept reading.
I might have done that.
Oh, too, Bob, right? Schirago was one of the worst, yeah. But they all had a hand in it. Schirago would even put on outfits.
One of my favorites, and I pulled this on every announcer there was, we used to have a crew of cleaning women who came in at night to clean the studios, and they usually didn't speak English. And very often, one of them would go into the studio while somebody was on the air, and they would just go ahead and dust while he was trying to introduce records or read the news. So every once in a while, I would take a big piece of cloth that we used for dusting equipment, put it on my head like a babushka, and take another rag and go in and start dusting the studio while he was reading something on the air.
Oh, I can remember some of the announcers, some of the things they do to break each other up.
Former engineer Dick Zwirko.
Was lighting the script on fire as they're reading the script.
I've heard these stories about people setting fire to copy. That's very, very dangerous. You could burn down a station that way.
I had one that I could break up at will. Bill Henry.
It was fun working with Arnold, but he had the ability to make me laugh.
Bill would plead with me, don't come into the studio. No, Arnold, please don't come in. I'm going to get fired.
And one day, Arnold was subbing on the afternoon record show, and I had to read some of the commercials in his program, and I started to read a commercial, and he did something, and I laughed through that entire 60-second commercial, and Arnold, being a clever guy, just kind of took the commercial and sort of recapped it so that the sponsor got his money's worth.
One of the people who was easiest to break up was Dick Bertel.
Who was the easiest to break up?
Oh, Bertel. Bertel didn't even need any help.
Let's check our bulletin board for today. Showing at the Sharon Playhouse in Sharon, Connecticut, between Tuesday, August 27th, and Saturday, August 31st. Just thought I'd cover that up so you wouldn't notice it. T.S. Eliot's comic drama, The Cocktail Party. Curtain time, 8:40. Maybe I ought to do that all the time. It was a Thursday matinee at 2:30. Call the box office. All right, I'm through.
The first time I ever saw Dick Martell, when they were showing me around the studio, he was sitting in FM. So he's in there, sitting all by himself in the FM studio, laughing away. He had just broken himself up. He was the easiest.
Most of us knew to leave him alone, because while he was laughing, he would name names. He would say what was going on and who was breaking him up.
Okay. Sessions will be held from 7 to 10 p.m. at chapter headquarters. Registration will be taken at the first class. For further information, call Safety Programs 249-7501. I'll repeat that. I shouldn't have looked up at the control room. Why do I do that? I should know better. 249. I'll give you the phone number later. Here is Miriam, come to my rescue.
In my opinion, it was the last of the big 1930s, 1940s radio stations operating in the 60s and 70s.
Former WTIC engineer, Bob Schirrego.
The standards, I think, were based pretty much on the network standards that were developed over the previous decades in the earlier days of radio, and TIC maintained those standards to a great degree.
Things they could do because they had the monetary backing of Travelers. You don't hear on radio anymore.
Former WTIC engineer, David Kaplan.
They did the Yale-Harvard Regatta. They would do different musical remotes at Christmas time and everything. It was a high-class operation. It was A number one.
The level of professionalism, like I say, and the level of talent that we had over there for the people. Well, everywhere. Actually, engineering, too. I mean, you know, top to bottom was a tremendous organization.
Former WTIC engineer, Wayne Mulligan.
I had often said, even back when I was there and since I've left, that I can't even think of the number of radio stations or television stations, for that matter, that you could staff with the professionals that we had there, and they would all be first class.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you just, you know, Bob Steele and, you know, Arnold Dean, and just on and on. Bruce Kern. I mean, you think about the people that were on the air on TV.
If you made an error on the air, the telephone right next to you would ring, and it would be somebody that was listening and made a comment about what you did on the air.
Former WTIC engineer, Fred Pearson.
So you always had that, not hanging over your head, really, as a threat, so to speak, but it really was a pride that everybody took at WTIC. You know, I grew up listening to that station. I grew up in Weathersfield listening to the Bob Steele Show. The pride that everybody took at that station, the product that we put out, was really something that we all worked together to make sure it was a number one issue.
But the commitment was first to the people, to inform the people.
Former WTIC sales executive, Bob Dunn.
The newscasts were built so that when a listener turned on the station in the morning, they wanted to make sure that the listener knew that, A, everything was okay in the community, if in fact it was. If it wasn't, if we were in danger from a weather threat or something else, well, you were to know that. But the philosophy was that the people should be informed in such a way that they know, okay, am I okay this morning? Is my community okay? Are we going to be okay? What happened overnight? What's possibly going to happen today? And so the commitment to the Travelers Weather Service, the news department, radio, and later on television, in my experience, was unequaled.
We were owned by the Travelers for all of those years.
Dick Bertel.
Both the AM and FM stations, and then the TV as well.
I guess somewhere maybe 1971 or 72.
Former WTIC sales executive, Bob Dunn.
There was a renewal challenge in Boston at one point where a group owned radio, television, and some newspaper in Boston. And the license challenge demanded that they sell off one of the entities. So as I understand it, again, not having been a part of the decision, there was someone at the Travelers in management who was concerned that at some point someone could challenge the license renewal of WTIC radio and or television, and that it would be perhaps a good idea to divest from one or both of those entities.
And in 1974, they sold it. Now, I remember the day that the announcement was made.
Former WTIC engineer, Dick Zwirko.
Leonard Patricelli, then president of WTIC, gathered everybody in TV Studio A and dropped the bomb that the patient would be sold.
So Post Newsweek showed an interest in buying Channel 3, and Leonard Patricelli and Bob Tyrrell set out to find an investor to work with them to buy the radio, and thus they partnered up with David Chase. So that sale went through in 1974, so WFSB, now the old WTIC Channel 3, the call letters based on the fellow by the name of Francis S. Beebe, who was with Post Newsweek and most responsible for the acquisition of WTIC Channel 3 back in the 70s. And WTIC and the ownership at that time, then Patricelli, Tyrrell, and Chase retained the rights, the name, the call letters WTIC, and also the naming rights WTIC should it ever be able to be applied to a television station, which, as you know, later in years it did.
Channel 61.
When Arnold Chase put Channel 61 on the air.
Leonard Patricelli and Bob Tyrrell and a fellow named Dave Chase bought the radio and AM and FM stations, and there was an incentive of, I think, $100,000 to move out of Broadcast House in a hurry. And I, along with the other engineers, were tasked to build the studios in One Financial Plaza. And we had a very short time, like a month or two, a month and a half or 2 months to completely have the studios built, not only physically, that they were physically built, some of the contractor built them, but we had to install all the electronic equipment, all of the wiring, and we worked 18, 20-hour days for weeks just trying to get the place going. And if we had a beautiful view up there of the Hartford area.
Plus, TIC had to remain on the air during all this, right?
Yes, it did. It remained in Broadcast House, and I can remember the cutover date, cutting the wires over and punching them on.
In 1976, the ratings, I guess, were going down. The audience was getting older, and we were still broadcasting in a style that was reminiscent of the 50s and 60s. And so, in 1976, they brought in a consultant, Mike Joseph.
The company had hired a consultant who was originally hired to come in and change the format on the FM. And he came in with some opinions about needing to do some things to the AM first, the mothership, if you will.
TIC-FM never did have good ratings on FM because, of course, the classical music listeners were far outnumbered by people who liked rock and other music.
There was the old guard who were very concerned about taking the classical music format off of the FM.
They decided to change the format, and it was quite a traumatic day for those lovers of fine music.
Desire 96 kicked off September from Earth, Wind, and Fire. That's a hit connection for Weaver High. This is Bill Lankybeal with Always Them, and that's a Tall Guy.
96 ticks. WTIC-FM.
They went into all hits and hired all new people.
Anyway, they went to the rock format and shot up to number one for years on the FM side. And AM used to be the number one in the station, and it even surpassed the AM in the number of listeners. So, but business-wise, I think it was a good move on the part of the owners, but it didn't please many of the loyal listeners of classical music.
But it boiled down to being a business decision.
Mike Joseph's claim to fame was that every station he consulted for, he turned into a hot hits station. And that meant, you know, playing top 40. And I knew that. And so I kind of saw the writing on the wall as far as the station is concerned.
And so some time was spent working on the AM.
One of the things he started to do was to bring in these nighttime personalities, and Jerry Williams was one of them.
Jerry Williams has a big mouth.
Very controversial talk show host.
He didn't last more than, I think, 2 months or so. And the reason for that, I think, he had a dispute with his station in Boston, and so he decided, well, I'll show them, I'll leave. And he came down, and he did the show for us, WTIC, and they brought the Corsairs in for the overnight show.
We're going to offer, hopefully, good company during that hour. When you wake up at, say, 2 and you come rolling down the stairs, look out the window, what do you see? There are no lights on in the neighborhood, and there is no time in the 24-hour period that we know as our day when you can feel as alone as you can during those hours.
Terrific Bill Corsair, midnight till 5 a.m., beginning Monday, here on WTIC Radio 1080.
If what you're looking for is a few laughs, some good company, a pleasant conversation, you just bought the concept of the Bill Corsair show.
We had Bill Corsair.
Arnold Dean.
Who did a much lighter show, which drew kind of a wacky audience, because when you're on the air with a 50,000-watt station and they can hear you in 19 states, you're going to get some people who are up at that hour, you know, talking to the evil spirits or something.
Yeah.
And so it was an interesting show in many respects.
It was a difficult time.
Ted Delacoux.
For the management, it was a difficult time for them to understand what the changes were like, but they knew they had to do something, and it was a difficult time for some of the air personnel, but it was also a terrifically exciting time because all these changes were taking place. You were part of being a new station because everything was new, the equipment was new, the studios were new, and the format was new, but at the same time, you were able to lean back on the reputation that TIC had in the market. It gave you a chance to really reach out and do some things. And we had a bigger budget than some stations, so we managed to do some other big things.
Wouldn't it be sad being lonely all alone?
Go.
WTIC, 7 before 2 o'clock on the Ted Dalakou Show. That's right, 7 minutes before news time and the Tom Tyler Show.
Tom Tyler went and did afternoon drive, Tom Melanson, and Mike Miller was doing talk at night. They had really changed the format quite a bit.
Some of the features in Bob Steele's program that really needed to evolve.
There was a time in the 70s.
Bob Steele's son, Phil Steele.
When my father really was going nuts trying to deal with the change in the music.
You know, Bob was more into big bands and...
Greg Gilmartin.
We were switching over to rock music, and Bob was having some difficulty with that, frankly.
I mean, he hated it. It was just awful, the music, the rock and roll, rock music and stuff that they would... Well, they didn't really play a lot of what you might call rock music, perhaps, but, you know, the popular music, a lot of the stuff that they were playing was the Bee Gees, let's an example. You know, he just didn't like that music, and in fact, he hated them. I mean, there were certain things that he got to like that he might not have, you know, they got used to, but...
Rogers and Sheena Easton. And this is Bob Steele suggesting you check your clock. We're coming up to the time signal.
It was very hard for him.
And there were times where he put a song on and walk out of the studio, and we could see him ranting and just angry with the changing that was happening.
He would get frustrated with some of the things that were happening at TIC, like when they wouldn't let him play his own music.
Bryant Thomas.
He got annoyed with that, and I think that, you know, it was just a question of trying to stave off the inevitable, that, you know, the owners knew that we couldn't go on playing Spike Jonze records, you know, ad infinitum and expect to have any audience. And I think that it was a big battle for him to stop playing the kind of stuff that he had been able to play for years under the Travelers regime.
They permitted him one oldie. You know, it sort of became his thing, the Bob Steele thing, that he was allowed to play this, have one oldie each morning.
And there were some times where there was a tug of war. But at the end of the day, everybody rationalized and realized that the industry was changing, the market was changing, and in order to be competitive, you had to make these changes. Eventually, the Chase family bought out the Patricelli Tyrrell interest so that it was solely owned by Chase.
So that was when
77
it was,
on.
So that was when it was called the 1080 Corporation? Or
that's right, yeah.
Can people, after the initial jolt of the format change and the disappointment that some of the longtime listeners had in hearing something different when they turned the radio on, I think that they came to appreciate that we were still operating in their best interest.
In 1991, Bob Steele hosted his last daily program. For 11 more years, Bob Steele continued on the WTIC airwaves with a monthly show, the first Saturday morning of the month from March to November. For that show, management allowed him full freedom to play any music he wanted to.
And then, of course, when he did his program the last decade, in the 90s, one Saturday a month, all of it was oldies. You know, he did his whatever music he wanted to, so that was kind of special.
His replacement in the early morning hours was newcomer Tom McCarthy, teamed with TIC veteran Arnold Dean.
Now back to Arnold Dean and Tom McCarthy.
Thanks, Dana. 20 minutes before 8 o'clock, 7:40 at WTIC AM 1080. Let's get a Tuesday traffic with the AAA's Mike Allen, WTIC's Air One. How goes the Tuesday traffic, Mike?
Well, looks like westbound 84.
You know, from the time I joined the station in 1965, and for a while, I would fill in for Steele whenever he was on vacation, and people would always assume, they would say, do you want to be the next Bob Steele, or do you think they're grooming you to be the next Bob Steele? I said, I don't want to be the next Bob Steele, but the station, assuming they had to go to lower demographics, wanted somebody younger, but they wanted somebody like me to kind of bridge the gap between Tom McCarthy and the Bob Steele fan. And so, consequently, they pleaded with me in every way. I did not want to get up in the morning. I didn't want to do the show, but they pleaded with me. Finally, they offered enough of a raise so that I said, all right, I'll do it.
Hear about the well-known Scottish cheese called the Loch Ness Munster? Did you know that nowhere in England is there a blood bank? However, there is a Liverpool. And finally, from Neil, a person should eat lots of shellfish for good muscle tone. So, Neil, thank you. And he gets
Neil, you should be ashamed of yourself.
He gets a Folgers Morning Mug for those three corny jokes du jour from WTIC.
Do you read labels carefully? Do you know what all the words...
We were doing pretty well. I think if they'd been patient with the show, we could have gone on. I'd rather be the guy who follows the guy who followed Bob Steele, because you can't follow that act.
The guy who followed the guy who followed Bob Steele was Ray Dunaway.
612 WTIC in the morning. Ray Dunaway, how are you? check a little sports next. Update some of the news headlines. Also be checking the forecast for you. First, floods, sweat and tears.
Yeah, I was working at a station in Kansas City. I was there 15 years, doing mornings, about 10 of those. And, you know, it was a great radio station. It'd be the equivalent of TIC in Kansas City. It didn't have 50,000 watts, but their 5,000 watts goes, you know, 700 miles because it's nice and flat and the ground conductivity, whatever. And so they were going through some changes, and you could see it coming. One thing that you do develop after being in this for a while is kind of a radar, kind of a sense of the sea, so to speak. And so I figured, these guys are paying me a lot of money, and the ratings are good, but if they could figure out a way to do it for less, you know. And the other thing was, I just think I wanted, I'd been there 15 years. I was getting kind of tired of it, even though it's my hometown. So I just picked up Radio and Records, one of the trades. They had an opening for TIC, morning guy. Yeah. Went, oh, that's Bob Steele, man. That's cool. So first time I'd ever applied for a job. And I called Greg Moshiri, who was the program director at the time. And I was a nervous wreck. I mean, I'd been doing this forever, and I'm a nervous, you know, it's TIC, for God's sake. And so I called this guy out of the blue, and I said, yeah, I'm kind of interested. He goes, oh, you know, send me a tape. And well, turns out a guy who'd consulted in Kansas City was consulting TIC. And so Moshiri asked him about me, and the guy said, oh, yeah, you know, I'll talk to this guy. So, you know, two months later, I was here. Yeah, it's the kind of thing where you're sitting there, and you know in the back of your mind for every moment, they're sitting there going, you know, you're not Bob Steele either. You know, and so God, for the first 6 months, it was frightening. Yeah. And of course, they're getting hate mail. They're getting, you know, oh, who's this clown you brought in? And oh my God, it was tough because you couldn't do what Bob did. So you've got to try and evolve into something that'll kind of accomplish the same thing. It's not going to get the numbers ever, but it's the same scent. And Bob was, for better or worse, the voice of Connecticut. Bottom line is that there's a great scene in Midnight Cowboy, and Joe Buck is coming into New York, and he's in the Meadowlands, and he turns on his little transistor radio. He's coming out from Texas, and there's WABC, and he goes, listen, lady, that's New York talking. And I think the whole thing is it is very much like running for office. You know, each and every day you're running for office. Yeah. And if they know you, odds are at least they're going to listen to you, not all the time, but at least they'll listen to you part of the time. And so it gives me a chance to do something that I enjoy doing, and it also helps me meet people. And I think that's important. If, like I say, if people know you, they'll listen. They may not like it, but they will. You know, so I think that's just, it's kind of like running for office. It's fun to do. I get to meet people. You get to hear different stories, and it gives you leads, things you might want to talk about. And it really is a cool place. Yeah. The history's great.
More than two decades later, Ray Dunaway is still the morning man at WTIC. At many stations around the country, that would be considered a record length of time. Still, he has a long way to go to reach the 66-year record of the late Bob Steele, who was at WTIC from 1936 until shortly before his death in 2002. In 2013, the city of Hartford renamed Grove Street, the site of WTIC's first home, in honor of Bob Steele. Though his last show aired in 2002, he is still fondly remembered by his listeners.
The funny thing about that last day is
Chris Francis.
No one really knew it was his last day. I kind of had a feeling that it was, not that he passed away a month later, and that's not why. I didn't think that was exactly going to happen, but it was the November, and it was going to be his last show until the following spring if he had decided he'd still want to do it. And I just remember thinking as the 10 o'clock news was approaching, this might be the very last time that I get to be on the air with Bob Steele. Just kind of had a sense that, you know what, this might be history here. I mean, he might decide he doesn't want to do this anymore.
He died a month after that last show, but the other thing that people remember was how he would close a program with saying goodbye in various languages, you know, pip pip and cheerio, sayonara, arrivederci, et cetera, from many different languages. And he would often go through a list of these. And I don't know if this is the only time he may have put it this way, but on that last show, his last words were, you know, as he went through the list of ways to say goodbye, and then he just said, well, what I'm trying to say is goodbye. Yeah. So those were his last words on the radio.
We'll say goodbye, I guess, this time. Another brief 4.5-hour program goes down the chute. And I thank you for tuning us in. I'm Bob Steele, HSG. Glenn Colligan engineered things. Chris Francis did the news. Scott Gray covered sports. And Sam Sampiri filled us in on the weather. I hope your favorite politician gets elected next Tuesday, and don't forget to vote. And I hope you have a nice Thanksgiving, a Merry Christmas, and a Happy New Year. Time to say adios, au revoir, do svidaniya, auf Wiedersehen, sayonara, and, well, you know, what I'm trying to say is Bye-bye.
This program is dedicated to the great Bob Steele and to those who participated in interviews but who passed away before the program was finished. Bob Ellsworth, Lonnie Jerev, Charlie Bagley, Kay Mahoney, Floyd Richards, Jack Lenhoff, Arnold Dean, John Reno, Fred Swanson.
There's a man you should know who puts on a show each night at a radio station. When you're going to bed, he gets up instead and it goes to his odd occupation, Judy.
Stay up, Dan, the all-night record man. Friend of every night owl music fan.
You've been listening to Connecticut Radio Memories, Episode 4. This program was produced and edited by Brandon Camp. Thanks to everyone who participated in interviews for this series, including those whose comments didn't make it to air. Interviews were edited for time, continuity, and clarity. Special thanks to WTIC News Talk 1080 and CBS Radio for allowing us to use archival audio, and to Jeff Hugabon, the chief engineer of WTIC, who is also curator of their archives. Special thanks to David Kaplan, webmaster of the WTIC alumni website. Special thanks also to Phil Steele, who let us use excerpts from his 7-CD set, Bob Steele, A Voice for the Ages. This series would not have been possible without the air check collectors and other people and organizations who had the foresight to save air checks, jingles, or theme songs, and who shared them with us, including Ed Bruder from ManForMars.com, Rick Kelly of Northeast Air Checks, Bob Gilmore of Bob Gilmore's Air Checks, John Ramsey of HartfordRadioHistory.com, Jeff Hugabon, Dick Bertel, David Kaplan, the Media Preservation Foundation, Tracy Carman, Doug Bain, the Library of Congress, Phil Steele, Bob Schirego, Arnold Dean, Wayne Norman, Ken and Bonnie Beatrice, and Barbara Manston. We want to send a shout-out to Bill Hennessy and the bunch of old broadcasters who meet monthly to hear the Hartford Jazz Orchestra play at the Arch Street Tavern. Special thanks also to John Ramsey. Connecticut Radio Memories was produced at the studios of WWUH-FM at the University of Hartford.